God has a plan for humanity. A lot of times, we don't realize what's going on behind the scenes. He is working, and He's working in ways that escape our attention a lot of times. The last time I spoke, I talked about the division of the kingdom of Israel back in the days just after King Solomon's time. And I showed that how God's plan for humanity began to be implemented clear back in the 900s BC. We don't realize, we don't see God's hand in every little thing. But that message was basically historic. Today I want to pick it up and look at the same issue from a prophetic sense. What happens back when God divided the nation of Israel between the two tribes to the south and the 10 tribes to the north? There also developed two different religious systems. That should be obvious. But there have been two biblical, Bible-based religious systems in existence for nearly 3,000 years. And particularly the last 2,000, because that northern religious system didn't develop out to its intended purpose until after the time of Christ. But the world looks at these two religious systems and sees them based on a single ethic. We know it as the Judeo-Christian ethic. Two different religions, two different systems, two different approaches to the worship of God. They have obvious philosophical differences. But as the world realizes, there's a common ethic. But throughout this long period of history, there have been two separate nations, two separate religious orientations, and I don't know that we realize the full extent, but two separate ethnicities. The 10 tribes are not and never were what we consider Jews. We know that, but the world somehow doesn't factor that into their thinking. One of these two nations, the Southern Kingdom, was somewhat united. But the other, the Northern tribes, were diverse. They exist in multiple nations. The 10 tribes are not a single nation presently. They're scattered throughout Europe and the rest of the world. They haven't been a single nation since the time of Parthia and Scythia, when they were driven over and beyond the Caucasian mountain range to the northwest back in the 3rd century AD. But there have been two biblical faiths, and I think we can credit them to God's creation. Why? Did one serve to contrast with the other? Both are Bible-based. Did the two, oriented as they were, served to further a mutual exclusion? These two religious systems, though Bible-based, don't want to merge. God had a plan for that as well, I believe. But when Christianity began, we might wonder, what further use did God have for the Old Testament religious system, what we might consider the Judaic faiths? Did he turn his back on that? Did he walk away from that? Did he intend that that system be discontinued? We can see from the results that the answer to that is very likely no. God intended these two systems to exist side by side throughout thousands of years. Now, it seems like the Christian persuasion is more amenable to the Jewish teachings than the other way around. There is some interface between the two faiths. We might put the messianic thinking in between somewhere, but it's inescapable that there are two separate religions now, and, I might say, there will be in the future. The Old Testament form of worship is preserved largely in the southern two tribes. The New Testament form of worship developed and is promoted primarily among what are the northern 10 tribes. The two tribes preserved a more rigid adherence to their form of worship. The 10 were more historically oriented to what we consider a liberal approach to religion. They're more accepting of new teachings, new ideas, to the idea of who is the Messiah. You find the acceptance of the Messiah more in the Christian faith than in the Jewish faith. The 10 tribes provided a practical inclination of Messiah acceptance in time, though theirs was not the true faith from the beginning. It was only after the time of Christ that they began to develop as God intended. But with a New Testament religion established, why perpetuate the old? This is a question that we might have. Were the Jews operating without God's backing? Think about it. And that brings us back to the enduring question, what was all of that for anyway? I mean, the Old Testament religious system is very involved, complex, all kinds of rituals, procedures, all kinds of observances. What was that all for? It's when we understand what it was for that we begin to realize the greater picture of how God is working in the background to bring His people, to prepare His people for the day when God is going to offer salvation to the entire world. That's not happening right now. It is to some extent among the few that God is calling, but for the most part, the world is not being worked with. It's not being called. Calling is a special thing. It says in John 6:44 that no man can come unto Christ unless the Father draw him. The Father is not drawing every person alive. But there's a time for that. And that's what we see in God's holy observances. Now, it's not a popular teaching in the Christian world, the teaching of the millennial kingdom, the teaching of the resurrection to judgment. There's an explanation presented that is a very different picture. You see, the millennial kingdom contradicts the idea, the ancient idea, of heaven and hell. God has a greater purpose for humanity than just an eternity in heaven or hell. He has a kingdom that's going to be on this earth for 1,000 years. And that kingdom is the all-important factor because it's in that kingdom when God is going to begin to work with all of humanity, to offer the opportunity for salvation to those who never had it or would have rejected it if they did. We know of people like that. And the idea of eternal judgment. The idea is that it's all right now. We're being judged right now. When you die, that's when your judgment comes. The judgment as it's presented in the Bible contradicts the concept of the immortal soul, of it being ever conscious. But maybe the biggest obstacle is the teaching, not popular at all in many Judaic religions, of a two-person Godhead, the Father and the Son. That's not popular. There was a major obstacle, and it even shows up in the pages of the New Testament in Acts 23, where it talks about the controversy between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. It shows that the Sadducees didn't believe in a resurrection. They didn't believe in the spirit world, where the Pharisees believed in both. But that thinking is deeply embedded in the greater consciousness of the Old Testament religious system. We can read in Matthew chapter 15, where Jesus said he was not sent, but to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. That's in Matthew 15:24. We would think that it was his purpose to convert first the Jews and maybe later the Gentiles. But he said what he said. He wasn't sent to them. John chapter 1 talks about him coming to his own, and his own received him not. Was there a purpose for that? Now in Matthew 10, he says the same thing to his disciples. He says, but rather go unto the lost sheep of the house of Israel. God's intent was to work first with the 10 tribes. But why would God want to preserve both forms of religion throughout all of this history? Well, the answer is, it's relevant to the millennial age. Because in the millennial age, there is going to be 2 worship systems. We may not recognize that, but we may not think that. But keep in mind, the book of Ezekiel, particularly the latter 10 chapters or so, presents a clear picture of the millennial worship system. And it's not what we might expect. Why do we think it's strange that there would be 2 worship systems in the future? There have been 2 for the last 2,000 years. There are 2 today. We're familiar with them. Why would it be a strange thing that there would still be 2 even after the millennium, the millennial kingdom is established? People might say, well, Jeroboam went pagan, which is true. I mean, after all, he embraced idolatry. He changed the festival dates. He worked to preserve the schism that was developing between the southern kingdom and the northern kingdom. But keep in mind, it was God who divided the nation in the first place, and the basis of that division was the fact that Jerusalem had drifted away from the true religion that God gave to them anyway. They were worshiping all kinds of pagan gods. You can read of that in 1 Kings chapter 11, particularly verse 33. where he talks about all of these foreign gods. That was why he broke up the nation. It wasn't just that Jeroboam was off track. They both were. That played into God's plan for what he intends to do, because God is going to use the greater ethnicity of Israel as his model nation to bring Christianity, or to bring the truth, to bring conversion to all of the world. That may not be so obvious, but that's the underlying plan. What does God think of the old covenant system, even today? Did God at any time reject that former system, which basically he gave to them? Do we regard, or does he regard, the Jewish religion, the Judaic faith as wrong, as originally given? I wouldn't say that. Do we regard the ceremonial system as ineffective and unnecessary, as it was originally given? Now, we can note in the New Testament that Jesus Christ criticized the people of that faith. But if we look at it carefully, he was criticizing the corruption, not what they were originally given, not the belief system itself. Major case of that you'll find in Matthew chapter 23. How the people worshipped, how they expressed their regard for God, was not entirely the system that he gave to them. In Romans 9, verse 18, we see something very important here. And keep in mind, this is part of the plan. This is not a derogatory comment. Not when we understand it. Romans 9, verse 18. Therefore, has he mercy on whom he will have mercy, and on whom he will, he hardens it. He hardens particular people. Go over to chapter 11, verse 32. Paul understood this. I'm going to start in verse 30. For as you in times past have not believed God, yet have now obtained mercy. He's talking to people who were becoming converted. For as you in times past have not believed God, yet have now obtained mercy through their unbelief, referring to the Jewish contingent, even so have these also now not believed, that through your mercy they also may obtain mercy, for God has concluded them all in unbelief, that he might have mercy upon all. That leaves us with the question, when is that going to happen? He is going to have mercy upon all. He's concluded them in a state of blindness for a time because he has a plan for them. 2 Corinthians 3. Paul brings this up again. Verses 13 through 16. And not as Moses, which put a veil over his face, that the children of Israel could not steadfastly look to the end of that which was abolished, but their minds were blinded, for until this day remains the same veil untaken away in the reading of the Old Testament. Their own texts, their own Bibles, they don't get it entirely. Which veil is done away in Christ? But even unto this day, when Moses is read, the veil is upon their heart. Nevertheless, when that person shall turn to the Lord, the veil shall be taken away. There is an enlightenment that comes with turning to the true God. We think that Jesus' primary mission was to convert the Judaic peoples. But he says in John 1, verse 11, he came to his own, and his own received him not. Now, did he fix it, or did he leave it be? The answer to that should be obvious. The question we have to answer is, why did God establish the Old Testament system in the first place? That, too, may not be obvious, but it had a reason. It was not willy-nilly. It was not just to burden them with all kinds of things they had to do. There was a reason for the Old Covenant system. And that reason carries forward through time. You see, those people, those who came out of Egypt, those who established the nation under Kings David and Solomon, who drifted off and worshipped all kinds of pagan gods, they were not converted. That system did not offer them conversion. What it did is it gave them illustrations of important biblical facts that they needed to understand so that they could become converted. All of those washings and ceremonies, all of that they did, it gave them access to God. They had to be at least physically pure and prepared to have access, to have an approach. But it didn't offer them conversion itself. It didn't address the real issue. It told them how to do it. It told them what was needed to do it. But it did not offer them remission of sins. The core of the new covenant, and we'll see this in the millennium, is found in Hebrews 8, verse 10. For this is the covenant that I will make with them after those days, says the Lord. I will put my laws in their inward parts and write it in their hearts. That is the new covenant. They understood it. It was prophesied in Jeremiah 31. Same words exactly. It's a perfect quote. What the Old Testament system offered them was the practical religion appropriate to those being lined up or prepared for conversion. And then once prepared, they're ready to enter the true faith. But there's important things that they have to accept. Now, this is something I heard many, many years ago in the Baptist church. And the evangelicals understand this. You'll hear it today in those people, in perhaps even the Adventists, I'm not sure, who talk about the Great Tribulation. You see, what there's going to be is there's going to be a full-blown dress rehearsal of the Old Testament sacrificial system just prior to the end of this age. The Protestant world, some of it at least, understands this. I heard of it as a kid, that there was going to be a temple restored, and if not the temple, at least the ceremonial sacrificial system is going to be established prior to the second coming. We can read of that in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27. Daniel 9, and it says, and he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, and in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifices and the oblation to cease, and for the overspreading of abominations he shall make it desolate, even unto the consummation, and that determined shall be poured upon the desolate. Complicated language. How do we know that that's talking about the end of the age? Well, Jesus Christ himself referred people. He says, when you see the abomination of desolation that you read of in the book of Daniel, know that the time is near. He's referring to this very passage, telling us that there is going to be a restoration for a short period of time of the sacrificial system in Jerusalem. In chapter 11, verse 31, there's another reference to it. It says, "And arms shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that makes desolate." The daily sacrificial system has to be established in order to be suspended again. Prophecy buffs know that. It's not something I invented. So the ceremonial system will be restored for a short time in this age. The evangelical world is fully aware of this, but they don't seem to understand why. They understand it only for its prophetic relevance. But they don't realize its ongoing application. What that will do, it's going to restore and work out the wrinkles in a system that they haven't practiced since 70 AD. When you restore something, when you restart something that you've done in the ancient past, it's going to take some doing to bring that practice into the modern age. They're not going to be carrying water pots anymore for the washings and all of that stuff. They'll have faucets and hoses. There's going to be some differences in the cleanup and so on. There's going to be differences from the exact way that the Old Testament prescribes. They got to work out the details to refresh themselves in how to do it. And that's why God is going to have that system restored just prior to the second coming. The Jewish community now has what they've needed for so long, the red heifer. They've sought that for decades. They need it for part of their ceremonies. Well, they've got three, last I heard. And at least one of those three, I would think, would be qualified. But we haven't heard much of that in the churches of God, less so in other religions. But WCG used to teach it. I remember back in about 1973, we would drive 2.5 hours each way to go to the monthly Bible study. That was in Mansfield, Massachusetts. Long ways from home. And the subject came up, and we cornered the minister, that was Fred Kellers at the time, and we asked him, would the sacrificial system be restored in the millennial kingdom? And he said plainly, yes, it will. And we pressed him for more answers, and we got none. That's as far as he would go. Now, Rex Sexton, another UCG minister, at the feast in Bend, Oregon in 2003, gave a message on this very subject. I heard about it, and I got in touch with him, and he sent me his audio tape. And he allowed me to transcribe it, and it's chapter 5 in my Millennial Kingdom booklet over there. 7 or 8 pages, very lengthy. But he explains why that system will be needed in the millennium. It's not for everyone. It's for a certain echelon, those people who would have a great deal of difficulty accepting Christ and becoming truly converted. There's a lot of people who get religious, but they're not necessarily truly converted. But why didn't that Old Testament system work among the Jewish people in Jesus' day? Didn't they have the law? The New Testament ideas, which were largely unacceptable to that ilk, was embraced only by a selected few. Most people are locked into a very overly religious worship system. In Ezekiel 29, and through the end of the book, there is a very detailed description of the millennial worship system. Now, it's pretty involved. It's pretty dramatic. It's pretty drastic. We wouldn't necessarily think along those lines. But God is explaining the worship system that is going to exist in the millennial age, the 1,000 years when Jesus Christ is going to reign on earth. And what we can gather from that is that these two systems are going to operate in concert with one another. When we study in detail, we'll realize that. But why would God take such an approach? Why would He do that? And what was the reason for the Old Testament system in the first place? It's the question that keeps coming up. The answer is, it helps to offer and facilitate true conversion to the element throughout history that has hated God, that has been ignorant of Him or of His plan, what we could consider as wicked generations. We can't think of just of ourselves and how we would approach this. We have to think of how others would. How do you reorient a rank pagan? We've got some of those in politics in this country, but I'll stay away from that. How do you reorient a Hindu or a Buddhist or a Shintoist? How do you reorient a secular academic God-hater that we see in our society? There are people who hate God in our culture. We know that. What about people who are intrinsically wicked themselves, who devise and practice evil continually? How to reorient that kind of a person? Someone who's into voodoo or witchcraft. How do you bring that kind of a person around to the point where they can begin to become truly converted, to receive God's Spirit, and to cleanse out their own spirit? It takes a lot more than an altar call, I'll tell you that, if you're familiar with an altar call and what that is. Prime example of that is the Billy Graham Crusades, if anyone remembers those. It was back in 1957. A carload of us were heading down to Madison Square Garden in New York to hear a Billy Graham crusade. Quite an experience. Probably over 20,000 people were there. But famously and traditionally, they always offer the altar call. They play that old hymn, "Just As I Am," and so on. Worked for years, worked for generations. But it's going to take more than an altar call to bring horribly misoriented or disoriented people to a point in their life where they can become truly converted. And that's what the old covenant system was for, not to convert those people. That should be evident. But it was to prepare their minds by the lessons that are contained in all of those ceremonies, to prepare their minds to the point where they could accept true conversion. They could accept what God is offering them. Now, one of the important things that is taught through the old covenant sacrificial system is illustrated very powerfully. It's what we find in Romans 6:23. The wages of sin is death. And that's repeated in Ezekiel 18 In two places, verse 4 and 20, the soul that sinneth, it shall die. Why? And in Hebrews 9, it tells us, without the shedding of blood, there is no remission. If you didn't get that message from the old covenant system, how would you ever get it? So even something as basic as that is illustrated in what they were doing, up to their elbows in blood from time to time. It taught them how remission of sin is facilitated. It requires the shedding of blood. Problem is, how does that happen? If you pay your own sins with your own blood, where are you? You're dead. So the underlying lesson in all of that is to accept Christ's sacrifice, where he shed his blood on our behalf, in our stead. We need to understand about sin that it cannot be absolved without the required penalty being imposed. Sin has a demand that has to be satisfied. We know it as the law of sin and death. Romans 8, chapter 2 refers to that. That is also a law. You sin, you die. It's a law. Can't escape it. We all have to deal with that. The law of sin and death. The law that says if you sin, blood has to be shed to absolve that sin. You see, that's the law. The law that was against us. The law that required our death. That's what was nailed to the cross. People don't understand that. It wasn't the commandments that were nailed to the cross. It was the law of sin and death that had its hold on us. Christ's sacrifice is what relieved us of that obligation. Now we're going to find that some Christian faiths are what we call antinomian. What that means is they're against the law. They reject the law. That's not the new covenant. Referred to it earlier, Hebrews 8, chapter 8, verse 8 through 10. This is the covenant that I will make with them after those days. The new covenant has the law embedded in the person's mind. The people of that persuasion, I have to say, will have to be satisfied with being called later. They put themselves in a category. God is going to call them, but in many cases, he will have mercy upon them, but it will be later. Now, most of this anti-law thing is related to the regard for the fourth commandment. I don't know of too many religious people out there that advocate murder or theft or idolatry or any of that. No. It's the fourth commandment. That's the problem. Revelation chapter 14, particularly the latter half of that chapter, explains how sin debt will become satisfied. It deals with the converted, and it deals with the unrepentant. It shows us that. The wrath of God will be shown in the winepress of his wrath. Once they've had opportunity, which the resurrection will provide them, which the millennial kingdom will provide those who survive into that time. Once they've had their opportunity and remain unrepentant, they will pay for their own sins with their own blood. They don't accept Christ's blood. The law still will be satisfied. Now, in the millennial kingdom, will religious worship become compulsory? Isaiah 66 talks about that. Will it become compulsory? Will it become exclusive? Isaiah 66, the very last couple of verses in the book of Isaiah. And keep in mind when Christ said that heaven and earth will pass away before his laws would pass away. This passage sort of reflects that. Verse 22, "For as the new heavens and the new earth, which I will make, shall remain before me, says the Lord, so shall your seed and your name remain. And it shall come to pass that from one new moon to another, and from one Sabbath to another, shall all flesh come to worship before me, says the Lord." Sabbath keeping is going to be restored when Christ returns. In Ezekiel chapters 40 and 41, it talks about the description of the temple, the millennial temple. In Ezekiel 43, 1 through 7, we see the Lord's presence in the temple, what is called the Shekinah glory. And what is that? The Bible talks about a supernatural light that glowed around religious objects or in natural things like clouds. This light represented God's presence. That supernatural glowing light is called the glory of God. We read of that phenomenon in many places, in the wilderness wanderings. The altar is described in Ezekiel 43. The conditions of acceptance, acceptable worship, is described in Ezekiel 44. And there we can see a reflection on the dual worship system that's going to exist. A form like the old covenant system for those that need to be brought to a state where they can enter the new covenant. It's not automatic. It's not a simple matter of an altar call. I'll skip ahead. Verse Ezekiel 45 talks about keeping the feasts. Ezekiel 47, the water outpouring from the temple. The Christian world knows very little about these things. It doesn't factor them into their arena of awareness. But God gave them to us. He wants us to know. I realize it's involved. I realize it takes a lot of careful study. That isn't necessarily what a brand new person is going to want to get into in any great depth. But let's at least be aware that He gave us this information so that we can prepare ourselves, because we're going to be a part of this. Anyone who's called of God, anyone who is in the first resurrection, is going to be a part of the administration of what we're reading about here. In John chapter 7, Jesus gave an exclamation, and we should read that. John chapter 7. And we can read from the context that this is given in the latter days of the observance of the Feast of Tabernacles in the fall. Yes, Jesus kept the feasts. Verse 37 said, "In the last day, that great day of the feast, Jesus stood and cried, 'If any man thirst, let him come unto me and drink. He that believes on me, as the scripture has said, out of his belly shall flow rivers of living water.'" Referring to God's Spirit. And you can't pour it out if you don't have it in to begin with. This pictures that time, the time that we call whosoever wills. That time when all of humanity is going to have the opportunity open to them that they may not have had in this lifetime. The millennial worship system will be the full implementation of the plan of redemption. It exists only in part right now. The old covenant system is a type for those being prepared for conversion. The New Testament system will operate right alongside it for the converted. There'll be no more false religion in the millennium. There'll be no more satanic influence. God has given us only a glimpse of the reality of His plan, of what He intends to do with His creation. He says in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 9, "Eye has not seen nor ear heard the things that God is preparing for those who love Him." Our Creator has been working for hundreds of years to prepare a people for what we call, and what the New Testament calls, the world to come. There's going to be another whole world, very different from the one we know now. We're given only a glimpse into the overall picture. But if we're going to be a part of it, we should know about it. That's what God's plan is.